Well, hello and welcome to a belated Archaeology News Weekly. Sorry about that. Life does have a way of getting in the way, sadly, sometimes. But here we are, and let's get straight on with it. This news is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resources website. All the stories have been collected from various sources, and to view details on each story, including the source, please see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. And now the main headlines from around the world are as follows. Online users can now virtually tour Otzi the Iceman's body. A 4,000-year-old axe is unearthed in London at the Olympic site, and the earliest known domestic horses have been found in Kazakhstan. A Neolithic seal is unearthed in Iran, and in Ireland, Lough Gur is proposed for heritage status. While in India, a Harappan-era cemetery and settlement have been found. Remains from Clovis cultures cast doubt on the comet destruction theory. And while we're still in the US, an ancient site in Utah may be replaced by a rail hub. Ice Age axes dredged from the North Sea win a top archaeology award, and one close to my heart. The mysterious kites of the Levant reveal an ancient hunting technique. Finally, experts try to decipher an ancient Iberian language. A Stone Age warrior frozen in an icy tomb for 5,300 years can now be viewed in astonishing detail thanks to a new website. The Iceman photo scan project took 150,000 high-definition images of the perfectly preserved mummy from 12 different angles, which the researchers loaded onto the new website, www.icemanphotoscan.eu. Just give you that again. That was www.icemanphotoscan.eu. This allows users to zoom into details that are just a few millimetres wide from the comfort of their own living rooms. They can also view the mummy in 3D and see its distinctive tattoos in both white and UV light. Nicknamed Otzi, the prehistoric hunter is complete with fur and grass robes, leather shoes and a bow and arrow. Otzi is kept in a specially built museum in Bolzano in Italy. Visitors view the mummy through portholes in the specially refrigerated room. The current preservation conditions of the mummy prevent the wider public from getting too close to it, but this intuitive zoom function lets users close in on interesting details, such as Otzi's numerous tattoos. Some scientists have speculated that the marks indicate a form of acupuncture. Well, I'll tell you that as soon as I've finished recording this, I'm going to pop across to that website and have a look for myself. A flint axe over 4,000 years old was the highlight of a crop of discoveries during a two-year archaeological investigation into the past of the Olympic Park in London, England. Over 140 trenches were dug on the 2.5-kilometre square Olympic Park in the UK's largest ever archaeological investigation. The unfinished axe, which archaeologists believe was deliberately placed in the waterlogged ground, was among several items found during Britain's largest ever search. Others included four prehistoric skeletons buried in graves around an Iron Age settlement, Roman coins, Roman river walls, medieval Neolithic pottery, and even a Second World War gun emplacement, and a complete 19th century boat used for hunting wildfowl on the lower River Lee. The Olympic Park is being built on the former industrial site in East London. We now know that the Olympic Park area was settled and utilised continuously from the prehistoric period onwards. What the Museum of London archaeologists had discovered, basically, is a London before London. An international team of archaeologists has uncovered the earliest known evidence of horses being domesticated by humans. The discovery suggests that horses were both ridden and milked. The findings could point to the very beginnings of horse domestication and the origins of the horse breeds we know today. Led by the Universities of Exeter and Bristol in the UK, the research is published on Friday the 6th of March in a leading academic journal, Science. The researchers have traced the origins of horse domestication back to the Botai culture of Kazakhstan around 5,500 years ago. This is about 1,000 years earlier than thought and about 2,000 years earlier than domestic horses are known to have been in Europe. The findings strongly suggest that horses were originally domesticated not just for riding, but also to provide food, including milk. The team of archaeologists developed three independent lines of evidence for early horse domestication. The shape and size of the skeletons from four sites were analysed and compared with bones of wild horses in the region from the same time, with domestic horses from centuries later in the Bronze Age, and also with Mongolian domestic horses. The researchers said the Botai animals were appreciably more slender than robust wild horses and more similar to domestic horses. This suggests that people were selecting wild horses for their physical attributes, which were then exaggerated through breeding. The second piece of evidence were the marks on the horse's teeth and damage to skeletal tissue in the mouths. The researchers said that this was caused by the wearing of mouthpieces, bits inserted for harnessing with a bridle or similar restraints to control working animals. Botai pottery yielded the third strand of evidence. Embedded in the clay pots were residues of carcass fat and fatty acids that were very likely from mare's milk. This confirms that at least some of the mares of the Botai were domesticated. The discovery may revive thinking about the development of some of pre-agricultural Eurasian societies and put an earlier date to their dispersal into Europe and elsewhere. These migrations are believed to have been associated with horse domestication and the spread of Indo-European languages. Archaeologists have unearthed an ancient cylinder seal dating to at least 3,500 years ago in Iran's northern Mazandaran province. Archaeological excavations at the Kellar Mound in the north of Iran have resulted in the discovery of a cylinder seal, which dates back to the Neolithic, decorated with a drawing of a goat. The priceless object is believed to have been used in business or trading. Oxford scientists have determined exact dates for the Kellar Mound by studying ancient coal and bone samples. Although many archaeologists believed that the area was not older than the Iron Age, carbon-14 studies have now dated the mound to more than 6,000 years ago. Lough Gur, one of Europe's most important archaeological sites, located in County Limerick in Ireland, could soon be awarded World Heritage status. Ireland boasts two listed World Heritage sites, that's Skellig Michael, which was listed in 1996, and the Archaeological Ensemble of the Bend of the Boyne in 1993. Limerick County Council has submitted an application to the Department of the Environment, Heritage and Local Government to have Lough Gur included on Ireland's tentative list of potential World Heritage sites. The site, 20 kilometres outside Limerick, includes stone circles and standing stones, ancient burial chambers, cairns and a Neolithic house, dating back more than 4,500 years. Well, good luck to them. Of course, I'm still basking in the glory that the Antonine Wall in Scotland managed to make it onto the World Heritage List. So, as I say, good luck to you there in Ireland. A big housing complex dating back from the Harappan era has been discovered in a little-known village about 40 kilometres from Rohtak in the Haryana state of India. A cemetery belonging to the same civilization from about 3,500 to 3,000 BCE has also been found at an adjacent site, where nearly 70 skeletons have been unearthed so far. The team of archaeologists discovered the settlement spread over 18.5 hectares, composed of four large complexes, as well as a cemetery spread of 3 hectares in size. This site is easily amongst the largest habitation locality of the Harappan era. So far, they've excavated one complex, which has 26 rooms, 3 to 4 kitchens, and an equal number of bathrooms, and a courtyard in the centre. The discovery holds enormous potential, as with a large sample size, it will be easier for scholars to determine the composition of the population, the prevalent customs, and whether they were indigenous or migrated from outside. As it stands, we still have no definite answers for a number of questions, including where the Harappans came from and why their highly sophisticated culture suddenly died out. DNA tests on bones might conclusively end the debate on whether the Harappans were an indigenous population or migrants. Trace element analysis will help chart their diet, and the team also plans to carry out coring tests in lakes around the site to ascertain climatic conditions prevalent at the time of the Harappan civilization, and to investigate whether the decline of the culture followed catastrophic climate change. The idea that a comet blasted into eastern North America about 10,900 years ago has been receiving a lot of media attention lately, including from us here at Stone Pages News. The explosion, which is said to have been the equivalent of a 100 million megaton bomb, supposedly caused the extinction of the giant mammals of the Ice Age, as well as the people who lived then. R.B. Firestone of the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory and numerous co-authors presented the basic argument in an article in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 2007. Since then, other research has cast considerable doubt on the claim. Most recently, J.P. Marlon, a geographer at the University of Oregon, and several co-authors dispute the claim of a single catastrophic event that triggered the Ice Age extinctions. Their paper, which appears in the current Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, makes it clear there is no evidence for continent-wide forest fires in the aftermath of a supposed comet impact. Firestone and colleagues also assert that the comet impact hypothesis explained the mysterious disappearance of the Clovis culture. From an archaeological perspective, however, the Clovis culture did not vanish, mysteriously or otherwise. In the centuries after the supposed comet impact, Paleo-Indian groups clearly related to the Clovis culture continue to thrive in eastern North America. The Debert site in Nova Scotia and the Parkhill site in southern Ontario are examples of large thriving post-Clovis communities sustained by hunting herds of caribou that also appear to have been doing just fine, in spite of living at what appears to have been ground zero. The Clovis culture adapted to changing environments across North America, and the descendants of these people adopted diverse ways of life that archaeologists eventually would come to recognize with different names. Those different names, however, do not imply that the parent culture disappeared or that a catastrophe is required to explain the transition from Clovis to later cultures. It's another one of these stories where the debate is going to rage on and on, I think. A rail site development could rob Utah of full understanding of their state's ancient past if the legislature allows construction on the site of a buried village in Draper. It's a site where preliminary digs in 2007 found tantalizing evidence that archaic American Indians up to 3,000 years ago were farming and preparing corn, hundreds of years before modern scientists previously believed farming had reached the Great Basin. It could indeed reshape our understanding of the development of agriculture in the West. Developer Whitewater Seven Holdings has preliminary city approval to build a transit-orientated village around a planned front-runner rail station on the private land further north, though the Utah Transit Authority prefers a swap for state land that includes the buried ancient village. The Utah House Political Subdivisions Committee approved a bill that would authorize, but not require, the swap. State archaeologist Kevin Jones oversaw the 2007 excavation that uncovered evidence of corn use. While he's not taken a position on the bill, he agrees that it is a significant discovery. Initial lab work indicates the presence of corn pollen, though experts are holding off on publishing the results until they are doubly sure. As he said, if you're going to change the cultural history by about 500 to 1,000 years, you want to get it right. Archaeologists until now agreed that Utah's ancient inhabitants did not learn corn farming from people to the south until the Fremont Indians occupied the northern Colorado Plateau around 2,000 years ago. The partial excavation, which unearthed a tiny fraction of the 250 acres of the state land, also found numerous cooking pits and thousands of cracked rocks that archaeologists believe were fractured when the villagers heated and dropped them into water for cooking food in baskets. Well, let's cross our fingers that either the site gets properly excavated or protected. Prehistoric hand axes discovered in sand and gravel dredged from the North Sea by Hansen Aggregates Marine have won the Best Archaeological Discovery Award at the British Archaeology Awards. 28 flint hand axes, which may be more than 100,000 years old, were discovered in marine sand and gravel delivered by Hansen to a Dutch wharf at Flushing, southwest Netherlands, in February this year. A Dutch amateur archaeologist has stumbled upon what has been described as one of the most important finds discovered in English waters. The axes show that deep in the Ice Age, mammoth hunters roamed across land that is now submerged by the sea. These are the first hand axes that experts are certain come from offshore in English waters, although there have been several finds on the beach, for example at Pake Field in Suffolk. The hand axes date to the Paleolithic, but exactly when is yet to be determined. While the hand axes were discovered in Holland, the gravel came from a licensed marine dredging area in English waters, known as Area 240, some 13 kilometres off Great Yarmouth, lying in water depths of around 25 metres. The award-winning hand axes and many other important archaeological finds have been preserved thanks to a reporting protocol set in place by the British Marine Aggregates Producers Association and English Heritage. Robert Langman, Hanson Marine Senior Resource Manager, said that the hand axes were collected over a three-month period, and this remarkable discovery only came to light when the archaeologists, realising their importance, informed the wharf owner. We were then quickly able to identify the area where the finds came from, and as part of the protocol with English Heritage, have moved the dredging to another part of the seabed. Well, let's hope it's not too late, or they don't actually go and discover something even more amazing. How did humans living in the 3rd millennium BCE manage to find sufficient quantities of meat in the arid desert regions? A new study of the desert kites that are spread out across the expanse of Israel's Negev and Arava desert region, carried out by researchers from the University of Haifa, unearths the answer to this riddle. Already in the early 20th century, British pilots flying over the Middle Eastern deserts identified strange forms spreading over hundreds of metres, sometimes even a few kilometres. The shapes looked like two long walls that meet at an angle, and the meeting point of each wall was a round-shaped trench. To the pilots, the shapes resembled kites, hence the new name given to them, desert kites. A few such kites are known in the deserts of Jordan, Syria, Israel and Sinai. Archaeologists have suggested a number of theories as to the use of these walls, most supposing that they were used for hunting purposes, others suggesting that they served as cattle pens. A few weeks ago, an interdisciplinary research group, funded by National Geographic, completed an encompassing study of all 11 kites of the Negev and Arava, which included archaeological digs in four of the kites, detailed documentation, aerial and ground photography, and dating by means of two independent radiometric methods. The study finds have clearly shown that the kites were used for mass hunting, dating back no later than the 3rd millennium BCE. The kite's branches can reach over 200 metres in length, and at the base of each kite the branches converge and end in a chasm or large trench. On some of the kites an elevated stage was erected, probably in order to heighten the leaping wall and perhaps to hide the trench that was dug beneath it. According to the researchers, the hunting method involved directing the indigenous wild animals alongside the walled branches of the kite towards its tip and trench, where hunters then awaited them. The height of the walls and their thickness testify that the apparatus was intended for hunting large animals as well, like wild ass and rams. The traps were placed in locations where animal migration routes were concentrated into bottlenecks, and there's no doubt that this reflects the prehistoric inhabitants' knowledge of cattle migration routes. They also knew where to place the traps most efficiently. And the reason I said it was a subject close to my heart was because actually of the work I was doing with Professor Kennedy and Fiona Baker out in Jordan. And I was lucky enough to go up with Professor Kennedy in an old Huey helicopter, and he's actually been doing a lot of the study of aerial photographs of the desert region. And these are amazing structures. And I have to say that I completely concur with the research. When archaeologists on a dig in southern Portugal last year flipped over a heavy chunk of slate and saw writing not used for more than 2,500 years, they were delighted. The enigmatic pattern of inscribed symbols curled symmetrically around the upper part of the rough-edged yellowish stone tablet and coiled into the middle in a decorative style typical of an extinct Iberian language called Southwest script. For more than two centuries, scientists have tried to decipher Southwest script, believed to be the peninsula's oldest written tongue, and, along with Etruscan from modern Italy, one of Europe's first. The stone tablet features 86 characters and provides the longest-running text of the Iron Age language ever found. About 90 slate tablets bearing the ancient inscriptions have been recovered, most of them incomplete. Almost all were scattered across southern Portugal, though a handful have turned up in neighbouring Spanish region of Andalusia. Southwest script is one of just a handful of ancient languages about which very little is known. The obscurity has, of course, provided fertile ground for the competing theories about who exactly wrote the words. It's generally agreed that the text dates to somewhere between 2,500 to 2,800 years ago. Most experts have concluded they were authored by people called the Tartessians, a tribe of Mediterranean traders who mined for metal in these parts. One of Europe's largest copper mines is, of course, nearby, but disappeared after a few centuries. Another translation difficulty is that the writing is not standardized. It seems certain it was adapted from the Phoenician and Greek alphabets because it's copied some of their writing conventions. However, it's also altered some of the rules and invented new ones. There's also a problem in figuring out what messages these late tablets are indeed trying to convey. Even when you can read portions of the text, scientists don't really understand what it's trying to say, like a child mouthing the words of a Shakespeare play. The lower part of the rectangular stone is always left blank, as if intended to be stuck in the ground. This has led experts to the supposition that the tablets were gravestones for elite members of the local Iron Age society. Repeated sequences of words perhaps mean "here lies" or "son of." Since most of the people probably couldn't read, the ornamental elements lend distinction. If all the Southwest script found so far was transcribed onto paper, it would still barely fill a single sheet. Without an equivalent of the Rosetta Stone, which helped unlock the secrets of hieroglyphic writing in Egypt, efforts to reconstruct the ancient language are doomed to slow progress. So there we go. If anyone who's a listener of the podcast can take this one on and get back to us next week with a full translation, we'd be very grateful. I know you can do it. So it just remains for me to say thank you very much for listening to Archaeology News Weekly. You'll be glad to know that, in fact, today, which is the 12th of March, we are just publishing the latest edition of the Past Horizons magazine, issue 7. It's packed full of quite amazing stories from artesian in Crimea to look at Malaysian rock art. What about some Easter Island? And we've got a report on the current archaeology conference that we went to in February. Tell you what, I'll stop talking about it. You get along and read it. You'll find it at www.pasthorizons.com/magazine and go to issue 7. Can I remind people also that there's many new archaeological and heritage employment opportunities, as well as a stacked UK heritage calendar, library and guidance section, all to be found on my own website, Badger, www.bajr.org. You can also, of course, catch up with us on our blogs, either Badger blog or Past Horizons blog. Remember, more can always be found at Stone Pages as well, news.stonepages.com. Thanks again for listening, and we hope you return again to us earlier on next week.